Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now, here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast, powered by First National. I'm Aaron Cameron. With me, of course, Adam Pawatic. I'd like to thank Granite REIT for sponsoring the video series as part of this live recording here at Real REIT. Our guest today is Mark Kenney, President and CEO of CAPREIT. Mark, thanks for coming on.
As always, thanks for having me, guys.
So this is episode number 3 with Mark. So if you're curious about Mark's background and how he ended up where he is today, you can go and find those episodes. But we're going to skip to the good part. Sitting here at Real REIT, sometime in September 2023, a couple things going on in our industry that has meaningful impact on all of us in the industry. Let's start with the fundamentals of apartments have been fairly strong throughout everything. COVID, where we are today, going forward, how do you feel about that?
The fundamentals were strong going into COVID. We had a housing shortage emerging, really call it 2018, 2017. It was hidden by the pandemic because we had household consolidation in Canada, very different than the US. You had Canadian kids in Canada living within an hour of mom and dad. Like most Canadian kids live in Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal. And generally speaking, they live an hour from mom and dad. In the US, that's a very different story. In the US, you have those under 30s living in states on the other side of the country, and it's just part of our culture. So we were more inclined as Canadians to bring our kids home and create vacancy and really weakness in the housing market because you had so much consolidation. You had people living at cottages full-time. You had people grouping up in homes full-time, and it was completely hidden, not to mention the construction slowdown and the acceleration of immigration and foreign students, which we can talk about in a bit if you'd like. But these conspiring factors, the apartment business has 10 years now of solid fundamental runway. Due to those factors, there's just no catching up.
Today, rents are at an all-time high. I mean, for the most part, across the country in all major urban centers, vacancies are near or at all-time lows. Is that about right?
I'd say completely wrong on your first point. And when it comes to rents being at all-time highs, this is complete nonsense BS. Use the case of Ontario. 90% of Ontario renters are protected by a guideline rent increase. It's only 10% of the portfolio that gets exposed to the market. So over the last 4 years, you've had the Canadian renters across the country protected by guidelines, but in Ontario in particular, getting less than a 2% increase. It's about 1.something%. In an inflationary environment, I'd say it's the greatest decline of rents in our country's history.
Very valid point.
Hold on to the rope. If you had first occupancy of a unit November 15th, 2018 or after, you are not subject to provincial rent controls in Ontario.
Which is the majority of the Ontario rent portfolio.
You think about the thousands, tens of hundreds of thousands of units built in the 1960s that occupy the entire GTA, all rent controls.
The headlines are coming from condo rents. The headlines are coming from the few units that are turning over in purpose-built, but the purpose-built industry is getting destroyed because of how low the rents are.
And how sticky the tenants are, because there's no rollover anymore.
There's no rollover. There's less than 10% of our portfolio that comes to market. 90% of those people are protected, regardless of their income. Like, don't ask me why in this country we have provincial governments that protect the wealthy. Think about that. Like, not all renters are poor. And so to have policy that protects all renters, because they're considered a secondary citizen class, with a less than 2% rent increase, it's offensive. But nobody's really talking about it because you're a high-income earner renter and you're benefiting from this government policy of a 2.5 cap in Ontario. You're not really protesting. But on the advocacy side, they're wholeheartedly focused on, and rightfully so, how expensive rents have become for units that are on the market. This is something that makes me cuckoo.
Okay, we're going to go two different directions.
I'm already cuckoo, okay.
Yeah, just keep going. I'm going to ask you about affordability first, and then we're going to talk about the implications of just sensationalized media.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, Mark's saying rents are getting more affordable, right?
Yeah, well, they become more affordable. Yeah.
So let's talk about the definition of affordability first.
Okay, I love this question. What is affordable? Well, let me start with the most affordable building in our portfolio. It happens to be where the rents are the absolute highest. And you're saying, what the hell is he talking about? Because the incomes are the highest in that building. So as a percentage of income, the percentage of income for our buildings at Tower Hill, which are some of our nicest, are the lowest because they're high income earners.
So as a percentage of renter income.
Right, so we use
which, by the way, is how CMHC defines affordability, right? 30% of renter income, so 30% of the income of the renters in those units is deemed affordable if that rent is below that.
A percentage of income. So if more than 30% of your income is going towards rent, you're breaching affordability. But that assumes all renters are poor, and they're not. So some of the most expensive apartment buildings in Canada have the highest degree of affordability when you look at income. So it's a bad definition. So like, what's affordable? So when you talk about new construction apartments that are getting built within, you know, certain programs, well, like I'm going to tell you $2,500 a month is not affordable to somebody that makes $30,000 a year. And it's outrageously affordable for somebody that makes $200,000 a year. So there's a lot of trouble in getting the definitions across the bow here and having a good understanding on that. There's a government bias to all renters are poor. And it's very, very sad. How do you build new supply with that being the mindset?
Well, it's predicated just on decades and generations of the Canadian belief that you finish your schooling, get a job, rent as short a possible time as possible before jumping into a home, right? That's just been the mentality of Canadians for decades, which then leads to policies like this that are geared to facilitate that segment of the market.
It's been geared and outdated for decades now in terms of, you know, government policy. You know, you want to flip to the real evil influence of what's happened here. Canada abandoned, and I'm picking up on political parties here. This happened under all government parties. We've abandoned social housing in our country. And so instead, we try to create affordability in the open marketplace and blame those evil investors for all of the problem. And that was working until now. There's suddenly folks have woken up and said, wow, there's actually a supply problem here. We've got to stop picking on the folks that are building it as being the source of the problem. Up until now, it's been easy. You can talk about the financialization of housing if you want to. That's another one that's just...
Go, Mark.
Okay, well, you may have heard this phrase, the financialization of housing, and it sounds quite evil. But what is it? What is the financialization of housing? Did anybody ever ask them, what the hell is it? You know, hopefully I get a chance to blurt it out on the panel today. But what they're saying is that apartment living, apartment housing, should not be a financial instrument. Well, by definition, purpose-built apartments have always been a financial
instrument.
Does it mean
that the owner, or the landlord, which is also another dirty word in my opinion, that the owner, the real estate owner, shouldn't make money off
of? That's the whole idea. Like, the premise is, how dare you make a profit on someone's housing?
Because it's an essential right.
That just means we have a country, we want no rental housing.
But do you think it's directed more at the landlords as scale or at individual homeowners? People that go, like, they own a home, they raise their family, they cash out for $3 million.
You're a smart guy asking smart questions, but even I can see what's going on here. Number one, I am completely supportive of the problem of investors buying single family homes as rental and driving up the prices, okay? That kills the Canadian dream. Now, we're not in that business. We don't buy homes. That's a big US business. That's where the financialization of housing first got its legs, is when neighborhoods are being destroyed by big investors coming up and buying up single family homes. Apartment rentals, by definition, have always been owned by investors since the dinosaurs. Well, if there was rentals back then.
It's in the language. It's purpose-built.
Purpose-built. It's an investment for the purpose of renting. Okay? But then what you said was, is it aimed at large corporate owners? So let's stop. This is the narrative out there. What are we doing different as large corporate entities owning this real estate than private guys? What's the difference in behavior? Point to it. Well, I can point to it. We have investments in ESG. We have investments in long-term sustainability of the asset. We have more secure homes. Our tenants love our investment in the assets because they're the beneficiary of those investments. And we have very modest return expectations. In the private market, where there's no visibility on any of this, none of this happens.
And no regulation.
None of it happens. So again, this narrative of big corporations coming in and acting badly. Well, stop. Where's the evidence of this? And I'll give you a good example of how cuckoo it's become. If I own 1,000 apartments in Toronto and I do 10 evictions in a year, I'm deemed to be a much worse landlord than a guy that owns a sixplex and does one eviction a year. Okay, who's the worst landlord? They can't account for the scale of the size. So just because you have more units doesn't mean your behavior is worse when you add up the total number.
Well, and evictions for cause, evictions, like there's a definition missing there.
Well, it's just the overall number. I'd start with just the math is wrong. They should be talking about the percentage. Percentage is what they should be. But that's not a headline grabber. It's 10 evictions versus one. We think the private sector should own rental buildings. Well, before we were around, it was the advocates beating up the private rental owners as being slumlords and bad behavior and all this. So nothing's gone away. It's just that, you know, we're the flavor of the month in terms of picking on someone.
How frustrated do you get while you're on this rant train on just media headlines? You know, a couple of them just recently about, you know, I saw this, you know, some sisters had their rent go from 3,000 to 9,000. This is what landlords are doing. And it was one unit. It's probably, you know, one guy that owns a condo unit.
Not the REIT.
Not the REIT.
Yeah.
You're not gouging your tenants? No?
No. Well, we're getting market rents on the 10% of the portfolio we can access each year. 10%. Not 90, they're getting less than 2% rent increases. The problem is it's a deeper question and it's the nature of media, okay? So, you know, I am extremely hesitant to do any sort of interview that's not live. The print is the worst. And when you're being quoted in a story, it's terrible. But if you're live, you can kind of express yourself and give context. The problem with written media now, which is the traditional form that everybody reads, is that there's no staff reporters. Everybody's paid for the story. If it's not sensational, you don't get paid. And so if you can't come up with something saleable, you don't get paid that week. And so it's created, you know, what used to be responsible investigative media that's balanced into sensationalized media because you're lucky to get someone. And then the nature of media, you know, I use the example. It was when I was a kid, I'd come home from school. And whether I liked it or not, my dad was sitting on the couch reading the newspaper. And whether I liked it or not, I read the headline and we talked about it at dinner. And during dinner, well, right after Three's Company, because we'd be watching Three's Company, the news would come on and there'd be more news and the family would sit and have a discussion about the news, whether I liked it or not. And so what was going on was a family discussion about current events and what's happening that allowed you to form a view. Depending on the household you're in, you had maybe one kind of view being sent versus another, but there was still a discussion and it was balanced and the type of reporting was, I'm going to call it fair, okay? Today, it's like if I like gardening, I click on all my gardening stories and I like whatever. And if to get me off my gardening app and get or my news feed, then I've got to see something really big. So if I can see a story about two sisters getting evicted for 9,000, who's not going to say that's terrible? Nobody. Nobody's going to say that's not terrible. It's like the financialization of housing. It sounds evil until you say, what is it? And people, I don't actually know what it is. That's a good question mark. So it's sad that we don't have balance in the media anymore.
In the modern world with the one-off hit pieces that you're talking about, is there anything our industry can do to make that work in our favor?
Well, you're doing it here. Like you're
we're media.
You're giving, you know, I'd like to see the other side a fair shake. And I think it's trying to be honest about what is the other side really saying. So when you look at like the advocacy side, you know, we share a lot of things in common. They just don't know who to blame. So they blame the private sector for all the problems. And they should be blaming government, quite frankly, for a variety of reasons that, you know, without doing the homework, you don't understand. We should have had social housing in this country on an ongoing investment basis. You can't just catch up overnight. And we should not have polarized the conversation about immigration and housing policy. It was always like, if you're a local voter, you vote for immigration, but God forbid you're a NIMBY and you don't vote for development in your backyard. And that's the same voter. They're voting one way for both issues. So, you know, the government can't hide anymore. They're looking for people to blame, but it takes, you know, I use the analogy, it takes 20 minutes to process a family of four at Pearson to come into our country. And it takes 7 years from beginning to end to build their home. Think about that. Like people, it's not a magic wand. You let a million people in, you know, 250
million houses. Yeah.
Well, 250,000, if there's four people in a house, you can't just go, okay, that's done. So like, there's just such a wobble of political agenda that I'll be very open about saying we all need to work together. Well, really it's just about saying, okay, here are the common problems and here's what I can contribute without letting politics overtake the discussion.
Is your pipeline for development growing? Stagnant? What's the...
The REIT industry in Canada has over 230,000 homes in the development pipeline. CAPREIT is not a development company by our background. Our contribution is getting our lands entitled for intensification and selling our older assets and buying new construction assets that are in the process of being built. So we are better to contribute in the ecosystem of new construction and creating new density than we are just being a straight out developer.
Is that a calculated decision? I mean, I totally appreciate it. Development is a beast and a complication. Wasn't your expertise, wasn't your historic, you know, expertise. And did you think about doing it and just made the decision not to, or did it just never felt right?
We had some bad starts and blew up some pro formas, and it's always back to the same, stick to what you know what you're doing. And in many cases, when you look at the development profit of going through that process versus the creation of value when you just get the land entitled, it's almost the same number. So like most developers won't tell you that because they're buying the land and putting it in a bigger pro forma. But for, in our case, when we're taking something with no value on the books and creating tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars of value, it's better just to trade that out. In places like Toronto, rental doesn't work. It just does not work. You can't make rental work at $1,300 a foot.
Like buying land at market.
You can't, and the you whole can't process. Do it. So your land has value, whether you bought it or you own it. It has value to attribute. And we'd rather take that value and put it into existing income product. That's what we're good at.
What's the good news story in the market these days?
The NIMBYs are losing ground. It's less about, you know, not in my backyard. And the wake up call, it always needs, you know, a frying pan over the head, it seems, for voters to wake up and go, wow, this is a serious, serious problem. So I'm very, very encouraged that, all governments are talking about housing. The narrative is off of, you know, corporates are bad and that they're the reason for all the problems. And I got to get off track a little bit. Like we had, and I don't mind calling this guy out, but we had the mayor of Nanaimo take a whack at us as an industry, the REIT industry, for being, you know, God forbid you ever end up in a REIT unit. And we talked to our peers and not a single one of the REITs own a single apartment in Nanaimo. So we wrote him a letter and said, you don't have to invoke the help of God. We will not come to Nanaimo. We will not build in Nanaimo, and you'll never see us in Nanaimo. And like, this is the political agenda of like stirring people up into a frenzy. Imagine attacking a sector that doesn't own a single unit in the marketplace. This is the mayor. This isn't like the province. This is the mayor of a city making a slanderous claim like that with no repercussion.
Well, making a headline specifically.
It's a headline. It sounds great. God forbid a REIT. Why? They're big. Oh, they must be terrible.
Yeah, well, professional management, well-capitalized, you don't want that.
And where's the evidence of bad behavior? The biggest problem that we have as a REIT industry is our financials are publicly disclosed. The private guys don't do that. So it becomes housing, profit, bad, put them out of business, which is just, you know, the last thing Canada needs is less capital for real estate. You know, CMHC makes the claim for 2030, we need $3 trillion of investment for housing. And to put that into context, the entire history of Canada debt hit $1 trillion. So we need to get $3 trillion additional dollars to do this.
Yeah, the government's not going to do it.
And the government says we're going to solve the problem. Like anyone that gets up there and claims that they can do it, they're lying politically. Again, it's the private sector. The private sector has always done this. The private sector is going to solve this problem. The government needs to get out of the way.
Can the private sector raise $3 trillion by 2030?
Well, I got to tell you, like if you look at the private market and you look at real estate owners, they can only leverage their own portfolios if there's leverage space available. When you look at the capital markets, you can tap into worldwide capital for investments that's worthwhile. Everybody on the planet Earth wants to invest in Canadian housing. They're just afraid of the government. For good reason. And so if it was stable, of course, like not $3 trillion, no, but we are absolutely a source of capital to help solve the housing crisis in Canada.
Now you have said publicly before in the newspaper that regulatory risk is the biggest threat to apartments.
The business fundamentals are a joke. There's no business fundamental issue going on here. You know, it's the limit of what people can pay in the general market, and that's not changing anytime soon.
Yeah, the challenge right now we're facing is the fundamentals work, the construction fundamentals do not. So the supply is now off again, unfortunately. I know you don't play in that space, but we're hearing that across the board.
Yeah, it's just the added, not headwind, the added hurricane that people aren't really talking about. We're busy complaining about development fees and the cost of land and the regulatory environment. These are absolute musts, but it's got nothing in comparison to the cost of funds and just the general cost environment to build. Like everybody's pens down. You know, but the problem is the left side of the argument assumes you're going to build no matter what. And what I have said, it's somewhat cheeky, is that nobody is preventing housing advocates from taking their life savings and losing it in a housing investment. There's no law against that. They can do it. Nobody said you're not allowed to participate.
That is cheeky.
No, but it is true. It is true. So, but what that point is trying to express is that investment won't go for the sake of losing money. Investment will go for a modest return on capital investment. If that modest return isn't there, investment won't go. That's obvious.
And people are always generous with somebody else's dollar.
Yeah, but are they really serving the community they claim to serve when you want to stop and attack supply? Like this business of there's no supply crisis, it's just about bad behavior. And this is all very short-sighted. But it does, but it surprises me that it's finally coming to the Canadian public narrative that immigration and foreign students do have effects on the housing market. And at a minimum, we can't facilitate it. When you've got, you know, foreign students living in shelters and new Canadians like living on tent cities, this is disgusting. This isn't the Canada that we've, you know, said to the world.
And unfortunately, Mark, as you well know, it's just going to get worse for now because there's no quick answer. You're not building however many number of units you need.
No magic wand.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. So we better get to interest rates.
Yeah.
And just how that's impacted your business and how that's impacting your decision-making today.
Yeah. Well, how it's affected the decision is that, you know, we're in a recycling of capital mode. So the good thing, again, about CAPREIT is the most liquid part of our portfolio is the non-core part of our portfolio, the real affordable stuff. There's a lot of buyers for that out there still. We're able to take that and pay down existing debt. And when you look at it, you go, well, when interest rates are close to 5% and the traditional yield spread that you need for investment is 150 basis points, well, that means you're buying 6.5 cap. No one's selling their asset for 6.5 cap. There's no leverage trade anymore, but there is recycling of capital. So, you know, there's programs that CMHC have out there like MLI Select, for example, where, you know, you're putting 95% leverage on an investment. So these aren't yield investors. These are investors that are banking on, you know, putting $3 million into a $50 million deal and seeing that number double. If the property goes up by $3 million, it's a leverage play. And it's pretty interesting in the current environment, but it's hard to match capital with real estate, income producing real estate today.
Mark, we're out of time. I know you have duties on the closing panel. Yeah. You're introducing, you're the chair of the forum today.
Yeah, I hate that job.
You're a busy guy.
Gotta read. I'd rather just express opinions. It's way easier.
Well, we gave you this outlet.
Yeah, there you go.
Get off your chest.
There you go.
Yeah, I'll have to have it back on because I don't think you got it all in your system. So
right. Maybe. Never will.
No. We want to thank, of course, the Real Estate Forums for hosting us today at Real REIT, Granite REIT, for sponsoring the video series. And of course, First National for powering the podcast. But most of all, Mark, thanks for coming back on the podcast with us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario license number 10514 and 11252.